free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what's our taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
All right, everybody, welcome back once again for another episode of the show here on this Monday, September 30th, 2013. Got an interesting program for you. I'll get to that in a minute. But coming up this week, as I said last week, I think I'm going to try to have a program here and there where it's just me talking about whatever's in the news and things that I need to get off my chest, and especially when I may not have time to do a full-fledged blog response or a written response. I've got half an hour a day to talk, and that'll be super helpful. Later this week, coming up tomorrow, we'll have Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America. So we're going to do a Guns 101 program here for those of you who want to admit that maybe you need to know more about guns than you do. You're afraid to tell this to your libertarian friends. Well, there's no shame here on the Tom Woods Show. So we'll be talking about that tomorrow. Bob Murphy, your good friend, will be with us on Wednesday. And for Bob, I'm just going to do open questions. Things you don't get about economics, you've been afraid to ask, or you don't know where to get the answer. Send me the questions. Send them to me. I mean, if you're on Twitter, tweet them to me with the hashtag AskMurphy. But also, I'll try to open up a thread on this on my blog at tomwoods.com. You can ask questions there. I'll try and get to that sometime today. But that's Wednesday. And Thursday, it'll just be me blabbing. And Friday, I think I'll have Professor Kevin Gutzman on, who's a great biographer of James Madison. He and I wrote a book together, and he's pretty sound on everything. And also, don't forget libertyclassroom.com. Learn the history and economics that you didn't get in school. And there's always a discount with coupon code SHOW in all caps. All right, I want to zip right over, though, to our guest, because this the subject of foreign policy kind of waxes and wanes in the public eye, in that when there's something on the front burner, whether it's Syria or something, people are very interested in, then not interested at all. But to me, it's a source of perennial interest. It may be the most important issue of all. It's the key to so many other issues, as Ron Paul himself has said repeatedly. So I'm very glad to be able to welcome to the program Daniel McAdams of the Ron Paul Institute. Daniel was the foreign policy and also civil liberties and defense advisor to Congressman Paul from 2001 to 2012, and has had quite an interesting career. But he's also, as you might expect, a great not only expert on foreign policy, but he can I like people who can explain things, right? Good explainers can convey important information to the general public. So we're going to have a lot to talk about today with our good friend Daniel McAdams. You can visit the Ron Paul Institute online at ronpaulinstitute.org, which I highly recommend. Daniel McAdams, are you with me today?
Yes, Tom. Thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
Thanks. The pleasure is mine. Let's start in, though, even though it seems almost – isn't it amazing how quickly Syria went from being a front burner crisis to now being yesterday's news, like ho-hum, people are already yawning about it.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think about this? This is very unusual, right, in American foreign policy history.
It's interesting, and I think it tells us a number of things, Tom. One is that the whole idea that the use of force should be a final option when everything else has failed is completely thrown out the window, because if this, as you say, was such a crisis a couple of weeks ago where even force was being considered, now all of a sudden nobody's talking about it. So obviously it wasn't the last possible choice that could be made.
Right. Which, yeah, I'm not sure we necessarily bought that to begin with, but it's fun to see it completely exploded. Well, you know, I wanted to have you on actually when I was hosting the Peter Schiff Show some time ago, and it turned out you were in Hawaii, one of these first world problems. Wrote a lot, so you were out in Hawaii. I couldn't get hold of you, but I wanted to have you come on, even though, it is slightly old news. I still want to – I think no fallacy is too old to be smashed. And I want to hear, how do you answer the claim that Obama's people have made that the progress that was made in Syria in terms of getting them to hand over their stockpile of chemical weapons wouldn't have been made if it hadn't been for the threats of military force on the part of the U.S.? So really, it's not Russia that deserves the credit for the breakthrough. It's Obama himself. I mean, what's your answer to that?
It's a pretty good spin, and, you know, it's tempting to say, okay, we'll take what we can get. You guys can take the credit. Everyone looks good. And I think the Russians probably knew that when they made this proposal, which, who knows, it may have been knocked around back and forth for months or longer than that even. And I think the Russians, you have to give them credit. They were looking for a diplomatic solution that would give the U.S. a face-saving measure and would defuse a situation which they understood would be explosive for everyone. So, if that's what it took to make them feel better, you know, we're sort of tempted to let them have that, I guess.
and the thing is, I would. But, I mean, do you think that it's – do you think there's something fake about it?
I think it's certainly an embellishment of the facts, you know. But I think the Russians were just literally astonished that the U.S. was considering first, you know. I mean, if you think about it, Obama was almost apologizing for it before it happened. Don't worry, just a shot across the bow, just to kind of send a message, no big deal, you know, and as if we're going to send a nasty letter from our lawyers. But we're talking about 1,000-pound payloads on these Tomahawk missiles, which anyone with a brain knows would have killed, I'm sure, orders of magnitude more people than these gas attacks or whatever they were that occurred on the outskirts of Damascus on the 21st.
Now, we have to be careful, of course, not to get too gleeful about this situation and to read into it more than is there. But the fact is, you know, as I've said on the Peter Schiff Show, the career of John McCain has had some very interesting twists and turns over the past 5 years. I mean, he went from being – you remember in late 2007, he was doing so badly in the polls that there were rumors he might actually drop out. Then he wound up firing everybody. He winds up getting the nomination. He's riding high. He loses. But, hey, you know, he was the GOP nominee. You can't take that away from him. And now in 2013, he is held in such low regard by everybody except the establishment whose respect he craves that – his whole worldview, it seems, at least for this glorious moment, it lies in tatters and is totally repudiated. Am I reading too much into this? I mean, maybe the neocons will be, or some of the Christian right people will be more likely to support the next war that comes along. It's not like they've all become anti-war, but this is still a interesting watershed moment, do you think?
Well, it's as you wrote to me the other day, Tom, it's almost impossible to parody John McCain. But it is, in a way, it is sort of the horrible fate of those of us who are interested in foreign affairs and foreign policy, because it's always the people like John McCain who want to be involved everywhere and do something no matter what the crisis is in the most remote part of the world. They're always the ones that are considered the, quote, experts. They're always the ones everyone listened to. And I remember back when I was serving on Dr. Paul's staff, at the time it was Tom Lantos, who was the chairman of the House of International Relations Committee that Dr. Paul was on. And it was the same thing. Everyone deferred to him. He was the great expert. But their expertise is, first of all, as you point out, in being wrong, everything they recommend is wrong. Yet somehow they're always listened to, and people that argue for restraint and for really getting an understanding of as much as we can of extremely complex issues, we don't get the credibility that the McCains and the Lantoses of the world get.
Yeah, the more wrong you are, and then they're just then he hires this woman who lied about her credentials. Like, I mean, the more you lie, the more interested they are in you. That's a separate issue. There's a pathology there. But before, I do want to talk to you, though, about your time You made reference just now to working for Congressman Paul. I want to talk about that in a minute, but I want to wrap up the Syria thing. You had a post over at ronpaulinstitute.org, which I highly recommend people read, by the way. You have an RSS feed on that blog?
We're working on it right now. We have limited individual RSS feeds for the different types of things we offer, but we're going to have a consolidated one very soon.
Okay, so for now, everybody, visit ronpaulinstitute.org. I mean, I know you feel like I already visit a lot of places, but it's called the Ron Paul Institute, for heaven's sake. Like, how could it be bad? It's run by Daniel McAdams, who's a great guy. It's where you can get some excellent foreign policy analysis. But you had this
and
post.
Sorry, Tom, to interrupt you, but I should just
no,
say
not
that,
at all.
And it's actually run by Ron Paul himself. You know, he's the founder and CEO. So this is Ron Paul. You know, and we're the only organization that he was willing to put his name on, and he's extremely involved in what we do. So I only carry on what I've been doing for Dr. Paul for all these years. Which is helping him, but this is his institute.
Well, this is great. Yeah, no, that's wonderful. I mean, so that the institute is kind of like carrying on. It's Ron Paul's congressional career, except without all the headaches and annoying jerks you have to deal with. Now you can just have speeches and articles and all this stuff reprinted and available on the site and get Ron Paul's commentary fresh. You don't hear him delivering it on the House floor, but you get it right there on your computer, just as good. But
sure.
You had
we don't have to be
there.
As nice to people like McCain and Buck McEwen.
No, that's
right. Used to have to. We could be nasty.
Yeah, right. You just probably show some kind of professional courtesy or something before. But so
yeah, that's all
going. From Thursday, the headline is UN agreement reached on Syria. Obama war hawks defeated on every count. Can you share that with us?
Well, on the two major things, what was really fascinating for me to watch is John Kerry. What an incredible, amazing person. He has been so spectacularly wrong-footed, foot in mouth, you name it. But remember, all along when we agreed, this agreement was reached on the destruction of the Syrian chemical weapons, he was insisting all along that any resolution before the UN Security Council would be brought up under Chapter 7, or Article 7, which would have provided for the use of force. And if you remember, this is the trick that the Obama administration used on Libya. Let's bring up a resolution under Chapter 7, but it doesn't explicitly call for war. And after a lot of cajoling, they got the Russians and Chinese to sign off on it, and boom, bombs away immediately. So the Russians were understandably hesitant to support such a thing, but Kerry nevertheless kept promising that this is what it would come up under Article 7. And when it finally came out, it was not brought up under Article 7, which means that if there is to be a use of force, it cannot occur under the resolution that the Security Council passed. So we would have to go back to it. So an enormous defeat. But all the way up until the end, Kerry was claiming that, oh, yes, this would happen. It would be under Article 7. You know, so it's it is an amazing defeat for Kerry personally. And, of course, no mention of of regime change at all in the article, which is the other thing that the administration wanted to have. And the third major thing that Obama was pushing for so much in this resolution was that it did not ascribe blame for the attack near Damascus on August 21st. And even in Obama's speech before the UN last week, he claimed, unequivocally, it was the Syrian government that did this attack. But no one else believes it in the whole world. So they weren't able to get this, into the resolution. So everything they wanted to lay the groundwork for a future attack was left out of this resolution. But, I mean, I'm with you, Tom. I don't think we should be overly optimistic. This is, at best, a tactical victory. And the cynic inside of me wonders if this very much welcome rapprochement with Iran over the past week is not to lay the groundwork to pursue regime change in Syria. So maybe I'm just too pessimistic.
Well, it is interesting to me to see did you see that letter that came out a few weeks ago by the Iowa GOP, and it was signed by many, many people. I mean, at least 30 people. A lot of them are very well known in the Christian right in Iowa. And all of them, all of a sudden – now, I'm not saying this to make fun of anybody because I like the people in the Iowa GOP, but some of these Christian right people, all of a sudden they're concerned about the fate of Christians in the Middle East, which they has not fazed them in 10 years. You tell them all about the fate of Christians in the Middle East, they couldn't care less. All of a sudden they care deeply about that. All of a sudden they care about the possibility maybe we're helping Al-Qaeda. Like all these things that should have been obvious for 10 years, now they're suddenly getting. I mean, that is at least some kind of admission from them that, well, you know, maybe there is another way of looking at this. It's not just commie pinkos on the one side and us super patriots on the other.
Yeah, and I think it, I mean, I probably focused to a disproportionate degree on talking about Christians killed in Syria. And part of the reason really is that, there are a lot of Christians who are misguided, I think, on the war issue here in the U.S. And so I've written a lot of things for the Institute's website and elsewhere, underscoring the threat that they face. And of course, every innocent being killed is lamentable, and certainly many Muslims are being killed as well. But really, for the American Christians, I wanted to point this out, that these are people who share your faith, and they're being killed by the people that we're supporting, who happen to not share very many of our values, I don't think, the extremists. And you saw this siege in this historic Christian village in Syria, where there were so many beautiful ancient icons and things of this nature, and monasteries, and by these radical jihadists who were, you know, beheading priests and bishops, and maybe that, because it got a little bit of news, maybe it did give a bit of a wake-up call, which is to be welcome, because as you know, sadly, our intervention in Iraq sent all the Iraqi Christians into Syria to, you know, because that was relatively a safe place for them under Assad, not a great guy, but nevertheless, that's where they went, so that's where they felt safe. And here they get there, and next thing you know, we're intervening in Syria, and then they're all getting killed there. So it's just terrible.
We're talking to Daniel McAdams, who's executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, which if you have not heard about this, you can rectify this tragedy today by visiting ronpaulinstitute.org, especially if you're thinking to yourself, I got money burning a hole in my pocket, and where could I donate it that would do some good? I would say the Ron Paul Institute would be a great place to think about. Were you working for Ron Paul you started working in 2001. Had you been working there for some time by September 11th, or did you come on board after September 11th?
Actually, it's funny because I had a clandestine phone call from a staff member who was thinking of leaving but did not want to leave Dr. Paul in the lurch. So he wanted to make sure, and I had been writing for Lou Rockwell for some time, so I was somewhat known in our circles, and I had this clandestine call, and I was, oh, good Lord, thank you. I was looking for a job, and I had admired Dr. Paul's work for quite some time while I was living in Europe. And all of a sudden, in the middle of this, 9/11 happened, and I thought, no, it's all going to be off now. But thankfully, this gentleman departed, and I was able to come on Dr. Paul's staff in October. So I missed that exact day. However, I was in for all of the Patriot Act and all of these things that followed, the FISA courts and all of these horrible attacks on our civil liberties. That Dr. Paul, as you know, warned everyone about, this is what's going to happen, and now we're finding out that it's even worse than we could have possibly imagined, how we've become the targets, not the terrorists.
Yeah, what was it like being in his office at that time when there weren't a whole lot of voices of reason at that point? So, I mean, if you guys must have been, even more than usual, the outliers.
Well, it was very nerve-wracking, to be honest with you, Tom, because, as you know, Congressman Paul comes from a very conservative and patriotic district in Texas, and the way these issues were portrayed at the time, there was a lot of emotion in the U.S. and on everyone, and, you know, they took advantage of that, the people who would pass these laws, they took advantage of this emotional reaction and the patriotism, and it was wrapped in the flag, and so it wasn't a great time. And thank God for the courage of Dr. Paul, because, you know, people that were saying what he was saying were called traitors. And I can't tell you how many thousands of calls we got in the office of people who were furious. And we fully expected, or we thought it certainly very, very possible that he could lose in 04 after, you know, that's when it was really the worst, because Iraq had just been invaded. And that was sort of the fever pitch, I think, of the whole thing. So it was very nerve-wracking, and we felt we had to, I mean, we had to fight, rhetorically speaking, from all sides, the left, the right, the center, It was not an easy time.
What was it like? What was the impression that you got in terms of what was it like for Ron Paul, especially, let's say, during the 2008 campaign in 2007, after he'd had that exchange with Giuliani? I mean, was he encouraged? Was he discouraged? Was he exhausted? Like, what was your how did you see him?
The great thing about Ron Paul is that nothing fazes him. he would have just had some amazing performance like the Giuliani or something of that nature, or an amazing whirlwind tour, and then he'd just sort of walk into the office and as if nothing had happened. he's just not fazed by these things. He really isn't, unless he's just great at not showing it. But we never really noticed anything. We didn't see him very much, you know, during the real heat of the campaigns. But, you know, when he came in, it was the same old thing. You know, the same old exercise routine, the same old lunch. And it was amazing.
Yeah, what was it like working for him in general? Like, are there any anecdotes that you can share that sort of illustrate the general sense of what it was like?
I think the thing about him was that he was so unfazed and he never took it personally. And how much we all learned from him, as much as we couldn't stand this member or that. It could never be a personal attack. It could never be personal. Always keep to the issues. And even people who personally got under his goat, under his craw, you know, it was never personal with him. It was about the issues.
So yeah, I don't know how he did that.
He had such a wry sense of humor. You know, there was, I won't mention any names, but there was one member who had treated Dr. Paul very, very badly over the years, and I think he was probably jealous of Dr. Paul's earned reputation as a constitutionalist. And but you know how everyone is so artificially friendly on the Hill. Oh, my great friend so-and-so, you know, who I just stabbed in the back. But so this gentleman, this member, who's a pretty high-ranking member, wrote one of these phony baloney notes. Oh, thank you for voting on my amendment of such and such. And Dr. Paul put it in my mailbox, in my inbox, with a little handwritten note. He's our friend. That's just his style, you know.
Yeah. All right. Now, there's a feature on the RonPaulInstitute.org website called Neocon Watch. Now, that's just beautiful, first of all. I love the idea of that. But you obviously would have had a lot of interaction with neocons, and, I mean, Dr. Paul, even more than battling against the left, probably is, you know, had to spend a lot of time fighting against the neocons. Who exactly are the neocons? Where do they come from? Is this just a term of derision that we use, that we throw at people we don't like, or does it have a real meaning?
There's a danger of being too general with that, and, you know, we take some liberties because I think the humanitarian interventionists on the left exhibit a lot of the traits of the neocons. And as we know, Dr. Paul delivered an historic speech on the neocons a few years back called Neocons, and I think he spelled it out in great detail, you know, their characteristics. So accurately that one of them kept calling us and demanding that he retract his speech. So he obviously hit a nerve. and that's what we wanted to do with this feature, is to kind of shine the light back on them, because they can't stand that they love to attack the rest of us who try to be sane, but they can't stand it when anyone puts their words back to them. But my interest in the neocons actually came well before I went to work for Dr. Paul. I was working in Europe at the time with a human rights group. And the neocons, as you know, had infiltrated, or from the beginning, things like the National Endowment for Democracy, which was really kind of a Reagan sop to the neocons. Here you guys can have this thing where you can do in the open what the CIA does in secret. But the neocons, with their Trotskyite worldview, you know, they believe in a permanent revolution. And so the idea of democratism, or the force spreading worldwide of their version of democracy by force, was so attractive to that sort of mentality. It's the mentality of the person who wants to force everyone else to do what they think you should do. So they were infiltrated into the NED, which is paid for by our tax dollars and had been since its creation in 1985 or 83, I believe. And then it has all these sister groups, the International Republican Institute, the National Democratic Institute, the labor unions get their cut out of it. And what they do is they go overseas and they give money to one particular party or another. They'll give money to a newspaper and they'll call it an independent newspaper. That's what they were doing in Albania at the time that I spent a lot of time there during the coup in 1996. So these people were the neocons. Even if you argue what they did during the Cold War had a purpose, which I won't give them that, but some I think can make that argument. Certainly at the end of the Cold War, when this great evil of communism was defeated, things like the National Endowment for Democracy and indeed NATO, they should have all gone by the wayside. They should have done what the Warsaw Pact did. But in the case of Ned and the neocons, they ramped it up and doubled down.
So it's the typical case, as in the domestic world, that, as Milton Friedman said, there's nothing so permanent as a temporary government program. That seems to be at least as true in foreign affairs.
Exactly. And who, you know, some poor attorney somewhere in the middle of the country, who wouldn't want a junket to go rewrite Albania's constitution? You know, so you get on board with one of these different law groups that gets money from NED, and you fly over there and have an exotic couple of weeks. Maybe you take a vacation, in some storied place as you're slaving away, rewriting their constitution, and it gives you a sense that you are bigger than you really are. You're larger and more important than you really are, and this is what they do.
We've got just
and
about 2 minutes. But we've got about just 2 minutes left. I want you to take that time to describe to people what exactly you're doing at the Ron Paul Institute, what Dr. Paul's doing, and what you hope ultimately will come out of it. Like what would be in 10 years, what do you want to see the Ron Paul Institute doing, and what's it doing now?
Well, philosophically, what I would like to do is I would like to establish the idea that non-interventionism is a legitimate foreign policy perspective. You know, there we have the realists and we have the neoconservatives and all these different schools, but non-interventionism should be established as a rational view of the world to leave people alone. And Dr. Paul, in fact, has not described himself as libertarian, but as non-interventionist across the board. So that's what we would like to raise, that idea, and we want to do it through education. We want to help train the next generation of people writing about foreign affairs and about politics, and that's why next year we will have a summer school for young college students to meet like-minded people, to hear lectures from our very distinguished board of advisors and academic advisors. You know, we have terrific people like Judge Napolitano on our board of advisors. We have Dennis Kucinich. It's a right-left board, and it's a grand coalition against war and in favor of civil liberties. So we want to help the next generation. We want to encourage them. We want to also give the tools to people who don't believe the mainstream media. They believe there's something wrong with it, and they want to turn. And that's why I was so encouraged when the Syria crisis hit that our readership just skyrocketed. So that's a great feeling. People are looking for something different, and that's what we want to provide them.
Well, Daniel, it is very, very important work you're doing. I never thought I would actually live to see non-interventionism becoming a real live option that's actually talked about. If reluctantly, of course, a lot of the powers that be don't want to talk about it, but you guys, thanks to Ron Paul, really have forced it into the public eye, and we're very grateful to you for that. I love the idea of the summer school. I love what you're doing. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Daniel McAdams, everybody, from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. RonPaulInstitute.org is the website. Don't forget LibertyClassroom.com. Learn the history and economics they didn't teach you and get a discount with coupon code SHOW in all caps. Don't forget this Wednesday we're going to be talking to Bob Murphy, your economist friend. What's your question about the economy? Ask it. Tweet it to me at Thomas E. Woods with hashtag AskMurphy. All right, do that. We got to get your questions answered for you here on the show. Anything you want me to comment on, shoot me a contact over at TomWoodsRadio.com or at TomWoods.com. I'll try and get to it this Thursday. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you soon.
The Tom Woods Show.